The following podcast is a production of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, we should begin. My name is Terry Wallace, and I'm a professor of law here at the Washington College of Law. And I want to welcome you to our session concerning corporate governance and codes of conduct. We have a panel. I'll introduce you. We have two of four so far. Quite an international panel. One is still coming in from Switzerland, but we think he's here at Dulles Airport, and we'll look forward to seeing him at some point. But let me introduce you to the panelists. First, we have Blake Wang, who is with the Chinese Cultural University in Taiwan. We have also Jihoon Cha, who's with the firm of Sewa Park and Ho in Korea. And we have here in the building and coming soon with his papers, Marco Lazo de la Vega Duran, who is from the from Bolivia, from the Bolivian Power Company. And finally, we have Daniel Feldman, who's we hope here and not in Switzerland, who's with the law firm of Foley Hall here in D.C. Again, our topic is corporate governance and corporate codes of conduct. And we're going to be asking the speakers to speak from their own professional experience and their own interest, make their own choices about their subject discussion. And we will then leave lots of time for questions. Along the way, here are a few questions, starting with the most basic of questions. What are codes of conduct? Why do we have them? How do they work? And in fact, do they work? What are the challenges to making them work? The implementation to even the structuring of codes of conduct. What are the prospects for the future? So without further ado, I'd like to have our panel start. And in fact, we have, we're waiting for our papers. So I thought we might start.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Blake Chen Yu Wang. I'm very happy to be here, and it's my deeply honor to join this panel as well as attend this conference. And thank you for Mr. Wallace organizing this panel, and later provide us some valuable comments. And my presentation today, if you have my draft, my topic is about corporate social responsibility and code of conduct of multinational corporations. And do they really success in current international legal order? I'm not putting so many deep questions today. I will generally introduce some legal documents which we have in the international legal order. And then, because I'm not the expert in corporate law, I just have some focusing on international legal order. So I will provide you some international practice about this issue. At the starting point, I would like to provide general background and introduction to the first question. What are corporate social responsibility and what is the code of conduct? If you can see the paper, multinational corporations have a significant role to play in promoting substantial development and global poverty. I would divide it into seven parts of to explain the development of corporate social responsibility and code of conduct in multinational corporations. The number one, in the early 90s, the attractiveness of foreign investment is in the less developed countries. And the number two, because neither the national law of the parent company or international law could reach into domestic affairs of other states. So number three, and yet immune Western customer public allowed multinational corporations to operate, perform illegal Number four, the rapid growth of technology and human rights activism and increase of customer awareness lead companies and corporate lawyers to complicate significance of stakeholders other than shareholders. The number five, so the companies, to some extent, were forced to reevaluate their operational process and the management mechanisms, despite of the fact that no binding law obligations them to do so. This is the present stage in the current evaluation of corporate social responsibility. And with regard to the code of conduct, this is the sixth part. Often related to the labor, environmental, or human rights issues, and it seeks to constrain socially undesirable behavior for transnational non-state actors, and they are adapted voluntarily by those actors. And the last part, such public welfare code of conduct, typically focusing on multinational corporations, by which it means a corporation's who affiliate business operate in more than one country, especially in developing world. The governance often unwilling or unable to regulate multinational corporations effectively, thus making voluntary public welfare codes an active means for promoting self-regulation multinational corporations. So we can see in the general background, the corporate social responsibility is very voluntary and then self-regulation. So there's no binding international laws to regulate these issues until now. The next session, I will introduce some sources of corporate social responsibilities. And at the beginning, I will introduce the public international law regarding corporate social responsibility. And the number one was 1976 OECD guidelines for multinational corporations. The OECD guidelines are recommendations addressed by governments to multinational corporations. Although they are not legally binding on multinational corporations, states have agreed to adhere to the guidelines and encourage their companies to observe them without whenever they operate. The guidelines contain recommendations on human rights, employment, and industrial relations, environment, fabric, consumer interests, science and technology, competition, and taxation. These guidelines basically establish recommendation standards of good conduct for all multinational corporations operating in or from OECD countries, including practice relating to taxation, financing, and information disclosure. On one hand, these guidelines have been used by labor groups to pressure multinational corporations, sometimes through the use of OECD or cooperative national governments. On the other hand, OECD report itself noticed 64 instances of early non-observance of the guidelines by multinational corporations that have been failed with national governments. So OECD guideline is very successful to regulate this kind of issue. However, in the 2000 revision, some observers were initial guidelines found that the OECD member countries had no intention to sacrifice their own control to follow the moral force behind those guidelines. So there's still some questions with this OECD guidelines. And the number two is 1990 UN Draft Code of Conduct for Transnational Corporations. This is in 1974. The UN Economic and Social Council adapted resolutions to establish both a UN Intergovernmental Commission and UN Center on Transnational Corporations. But this failed because in the 1990 draft, there was never finalized and never adopted by UN General Assembly due to serious disagreement among states, arising a large part for the residents of developing states. By 1994, the United Nations had significantly downgraded the United Nations Intergovernmental Commission and had terminated the UN chapters on transnational corporations. So this draft code of conduct was failed already. And then number three, I will provide the GATT and WTO systems in 1995. The WTO agreements on technical barriers to trade, which we call TBTs, and the SPS, sanitary and phytosanitary measures, establish an obligation on states to use relevant standards developed by appropriate international organizations as a base for national regulations affecting internationally traded goods. First, as with the TBT and SPS agreement under the WTO, a presumption could be created that national measures based on internationally agreed upon standards on topics such as environmental protection or human rights would be valid. Some are presumption are valid would help to prevent disputes or claims based on indirect discrimination or de facto expropriation. And the second, international agreements and standards could be associated with a multinational investing framework, either on a required or conditional basis. And some of these international instruments might be considered to embody some core values and standards that they should form an essential part of package. So in the TBT and SPS under the WTO and GATT regime, the states, we know now there's more than 150 countries joined into the WTO system. So if a country not applying for the TBT or SPS, another country will go through the dispute resolution panels, and the legal enforcement of WTO is success in current international legal order. So WTO systems will be successful in this part. And the number four, I will provide 1999 International Legal Organization Tri-Practice Declaration of Principles. These declarations call for multinational corporations to pursue policies that promote equal opportunity, security, and collective bargaining in employment, and policies that particularly dismiss strike breaking and other unfair practices. Some observers see this ILO declaration as still a good instrument, keep relevance by predict surveys and the effort given to the declaration by governments and by employees and by workers' organizations. So this tri-practice means the government, the employer, and the workers will work together. So this kind of ILO principles is still work. And the number five is 1999 United Nations Global Compact. The UN Global Compact was formally launched in September 2000 by the UN Secretary General, who called on the world business leader to voluntarily embrace and enact the nine compact principles in the individual corporation practice and support complementary public policy initiatives. The Global Compact is a voluntary initiative, so the practices, including many developing states, know that there is lack of monitoring and enforcement provides. So there's a little conference that corporations were compelled with these guidelines. So the above I mentioned was in the international law, the structure of international legal order. And the next part, I will introduce two principles in the NGO guidelines for corporate social responsibility. And the first one was 1977. It's called Sullivan Principles. This is best known public welfare code of conduct for multinational corporations. It's commonly referred to as Sullivan Principles. these principles were due to increasingly public criticism of Western multinational corporations with operations in South Africa, where the government was actively engaged in systems and apparent in which non-whites were systematically denied basic civil and political rights and denied fundamental employment, education, and housing opportunities. So in response, leading multinational corporations put themselves into the Solomon Principles, which contains 8 principles of how multinational corporations operating in South Africa should conduct themselves with respect. Now, hundreds of multinational corporations, including the Chevron, Coca-Cola, and General Motors, GE, have put themselves to these principles. So, Solomon Principles is very successful in this current world. And the number 7 is Global Reporting Initiative, we call GRI. The most well-known self-performance standard is Global Reporting Initiative that focuses on economic, environmental, and social demands of corporate activities, products, and services. This GRI substantially reporting guidelines were first issued in 1999 and are renewed regularly. It is together with the acceptance under the relevant compact reporting procedures. And the last, I will introduce some self-regulations called corporate code of conduct. The corporate code of conduct are policy statements that outline the ethical standards of conduct to which a corporation should adhere. This might take the form of general policy statement or be interest in the corporation's contract with suppliers, buying agencies, or contractors. In the sense, they must agree to abide by the company's ethical standards. This is also the self-regulation. So the next part and the conclusion, I will introduce and discuss some enforcement and challenges for the issues of corporate social responsibility and code of conduct. And I will provide some points. The first point, number 1, is voluntary social reporting. Besides the few instances of domestic legislation demanding that certain corporations submit social and environmental reports, all other reporting initiatives are voluntary. The reporting of human rights, including sense health, safety, and environmental, were found to be the most common types of reports, and also financial, social, and environmental information with single or separate report is known as trilateral bottom line. In any event, since the production of voluntary reports is also aimed at stakeholders, including customers, this will only be reliable where they contain the paramount matters specifically about by global reporting initiatives, as consumer groups and interest NGOs will seek to verify every statement made. And the number 2, corporate social responsibility will integrate the management and corporate governance. Since the corporate social responsibility is found in the reasoning that the company owes the duties not only to its shareholders, but also its stakeholders, it follows that corporate governance structure and management regimes that accommodate the former to the determined and later must be replaced. So in order to ensure corporate social responsibility contains all levels of management and production, some corporations have established the corporate social responsibility department. It's like the sales department or the finance department or accounting department. These ethical aspects of management products might foremost be incorporated into the business schools and taught as a component in business degrees. And number 3, corporate social responsibility responsibility is like a marketing approach to voluntary commitment. The relationship between a good brand image or profile and corporate social responsibility is apparent. This has given rise to marketing mechanism that maximize good brand image. We call this like cost-related marketing. The cost-related marketing is a commercial activity by which business and charities of good cause form a partnership with each other to market an image, product, or service for mutual benefits. Most, if not all, multinational corporations are now associated independent organizations or similar foundations which they have established. In the last part, I will introduce the promoting transparency and oversight procedures. The governments might require, through national laws, regulations, or administrative rules, that when multinational corporations adopt an internal code of conduct, and multinational corporations publicly information about what the code says, who is trained, and the code, and how, and information on whether and how the code is moderate and audible. While this disclosure may be bothersome to a multinational corporation, it also serves an objective of accountability of the multinational corporations to its shareholders and makes more effective the market mechanism that steer companies towards responsible conduct. So my last point was the corporate social responsibility is a developing issue in international law, and because in the traditional international law, the standing for the party should be the nation or state or international organization. And it's not multinational corporations. So it's very hard to negotiate international treaties to regulate this corporate social responsibility. So in right now, we're still using the self-regulation and voluntary performance, and it's not very successful in the current international environment. So we have to put ourselves in our government or domestic regulations to put it into the domestic law to regulate what the company would register in certain countries and cooperate together to facilitate this corporate social responsibility. In my country, Taiwan, corporate social responsibility is very hard issues in this perspective because our corporate laws and security regulations is very similar to the code in the United States. So where the United States regulations focusing on the corporate social responsibility, and Taiwan, the scholars will discuss these issues in these years. So we'll see these issues may be hard in the future. And if you have the documents that I provide, you can see the last page. I provide some reference materials and further reading articles, which I was read these articles before I came here, and I just summarize and drop this article and present to you, and hope we can have some questions and discussions later. Okay, thank you.
Good. I was really surprised to see
Provide labor standards. idea is related to labor standards or economic standards or even some human rights issues to trade agreements. Being said, why they want to relate to this issue sometimes is as you all know, human rights, international human rights, even though in the textbook it has a binding clause, but actually, what you know, they cannot understand. It's difficult to understand what is the binding clause of international human rights clause. Even though a country violates international human rights law, there is a sanction. There's any sort of claim. So when somebody led to his issue to trade agreement, they hope they can get a binding force when they relate to this issue. This issue to trade up because trade up wants is a moral binding force. When they have a country by way of trade up, they can distinguish in terms of economy. And the other, but this approach does the focus on the host country, not their a specific company, that means a specific corporation. And the other approach is the code of conduct. We are now discussing these issues. Code of conduct is really different. Code of conduct focuses on not a host country, but a special concept, special international cooperation. The basic idea is that even though company is not any subject of international law, or even though company operate operate anywhere, they should respect the human rights, daily human rights. So if they violate human rights anywhere, they have to be blamed or have to be international society should not. So in this code of conduct, we can see a lot of proliferation of code of conduct. Mr. Wang already introduced this old that code of conduct. There are code of conduct not only from NGO side or companies, but also nowadays even international organizations. OECD already has its guideline. It has a long history from 1960s to recently, and they renewed a couple of times, and they try to put more enforcement to this guideline. And in terms of your United Nations, they also they provide a global compact. At this, the first global compact is just complementary gestures. But nowadays, under the pressure of civil society, and maybe I think they also respect anyway the pressure of the civil society, United Nations also hold further. They enlist, even though there is no specific implementation system, under the even under the global compact, the affiliated company should report anyway, should report to United Nations anyway, everywhere, every year. So it's also, it means sort of lesser to monitor
nowadays we have a lot of standards, not only from company but engineers, but also to the international associations as great authority. But what is the problem? We still, even though proliferation of the product contract, we still complain about the company's behavior, bad behavior. We still have a lot of issues which was not solved yet. We still complain. We need more effective way to address this issue. Why? Because implementation system is there. The issue is how we can implement for the content more effectively. This is a more basic issue related to code of conduct. Nowadays, you can see two approaches to this to enhance effectiveness of code of conduct. One is this is very ambitious. Somebody wants to put a binding force to code of conduct. They want international law, not any code, to regulate destination cooperation. We can see that kind of initiative in UN's bad law. Mr. Wang includes a piece of the UN regulations. Even though it pays means that it was UN Subcommission's draft law was adopted by the Subcommission. Subcommission is right now request to human rights commission. But anyway, the General Assembly does not adopted that the draft. But the idea in the draft is implementation system. They realize the problem of the code of conduct. So the design of the UN Commission's law, they hope more specific their implementation system. But as we witnessed, it's extremely difficult to adapt international law, any international law, to regulate directly destination operation from ISM. Because theoretically, when we try to make any international law, to regulate directly without through the state fund, we faced one of the big barriers. Under the international law, cooperation is not an actor, just state fund is an actor. So international law simply, under the traditional international law, the cooperation could not be self-governing national law. And more importantly, deep disagreement between countries. And I think no country will support the kind of idea, because it means that when a country acceding the international law, which has British jurisdiction over the private person, it means that he lose his sovereignty in terms of the jurisdiction. So there is no proponent in terms of the international law and constituencies. But in domestic level, in domestic level, it might be more easier because in domestic society, certain country gets more proponents than more proponents. For example, in the United States, in Australia, I was told that Australian Parliament initiated their law to regulate the residential corporation directly. But I have not yet heard yet here. But in the Western level, we can imagine it is more easier to make a regulation to regulate transnational corporation. And Asian Pacific Climate, even though it is designated to regulate TNCs or not, anyway, nowadays it can be used. And I can see also the possibility in international criminal law. Under the statute of international criminal court, we accepted the notion of the universal jurisdiction. So it means that universal jurisdiction is any special court of the domestic country, court can have a jurisdiction over the transnational issues. So I think in the domestic level, it is more easier to have a law to regulate transnational behavior. And second approach is the enhancement of the implementation of self-abide by the country. Means that anyway, code of conduct is voluntary based, so it needs cooperation. Cooperation means that provide more general sense. For example, when early 1990s Levi's approach to China, civil society protested, and under the pressure of the civil society and NGOs, Levi's gave up to operate in China. But the problem is, other competitors took advantage of that movement. So the issue is, even though NGOs or civil society can press a company and to protect or follow their potential human rights standards, others can, there is possibility always others for others to take advantage of that movement. So in terms of this point, we need to broaden implementation, not only just for one company or one sector. It needs to be at least broadened to industry itself. So nowadays we can see some initiatives industry level. For example, International Toy Industry Association should have made its own code of conduct, and most of the big toy companies appear in the code of conduct. And in terms of the authority, because the code of conduct is soft law, no binding force, so even though it has no binding force, it needs, if it has more authority, it could be more helpful. Means that in this environment, other than any private commitment, code of conduct usually commitments of the NGO or a company, sometimes, or association. It's all private sectors. So it can be easily, ignored. But when authority violates this commitment, it could be more way. I mean, for example, United Nations, the Global Compact, I told you, it is a compliment. At first, it was a compliment. But, for example, in Korea, big Korean e-companies. Think of the global company, because it is initiative not by the NGOs or any associates, but initiatives by United Nations. And simply they realize that, oh, this is sort of the trends and sort of the more, they feel more weight when they see initiatives by the United Nations. And OECD also, we can say, OECD is an authoritative organization between the governments. So OECD push national contact point, you know, is of course one of the implementations of the system. National contact point is a mandate under the OECD guideline. So Korean government should anyway keep this national contact point, and any NGOs, any victims can use and use the national contact point. So it means that this code of conduct should be not only any private sector's commitment, but also need to be a more environmental, more assertive organization. When this happens, the time it could be more useful. And lastly, I would like to point out cooperation. When we succeed to meet the code of conduct. For example, a couple of years ago, I involved with investigation of a Korean company which operated in Mexico. It was blamed to hire a couple of workers when they made a trade union. Korean NGO investigated with cooperation with American NGO, which pushed the buyers, Nike and Adidas, and with the cooperation of the Mexican NGO, they cooperated with us with a lot of local information. And we can resolve this case with the help of the United States NGOs, which they contact with buyers. And we contact with Korean companies. So cooperation between the buyers NGOs and the manufacturing countries NGOs and local NGOs, we can, with this cooperation, we can be a good maker, have a contribution to resolve the case. So at least the code of conduct is voluntary based. I think
cooperation is very important. Thank you. I wanted to thank Ben for coming back into the country and coming here. I don't see how you do it. You're still walking on both feet and alert and alive and everything. So we already admire you. And what we've been doing is sharing our own experience and views about corporate governance and codes of conduct. I don't know if you want to rest a bit before we jump in.
I'm sorry for being late, and as I guess you heard, I for those of you who follow the issue of transnational corporations and human rights closely, I was in Geneva yesterday for a full-day session that Mary Robinson hosted for John Ruby, who is the special representative appointed by former Secretary General corporations and their rights and their responsibilities regarding human rights. His mandate was initially 2 years. He's 18 months into that, and he's asking for another year at the Human Rights Council this year, this week. And as soon as he gets that extra year, he pulled together a group of about 20 people, representative of both the corporate world and the environmental world, to help him make priorities in terms of what he should be looking at. So I did that all day yesterday. I took the first flight out this morning. Arrived probably just as it was starting. So the issue, the only thing you should respect me for is not being tired, but the fact that I was able to change into a suit at Dulles in the bathroom while I was waiting for my luggage and everything else. So I managed to get here in one piece. I'm sorry I missed the foundation that's been laid by hopefully not to repeat too much about it. I'll give maybe just a few minutes of overview about both our practice and then try to get at the central question on whether codes of conduct are effective actually at promoting change. I've been doing this in various iterations for the last 20 years or so since graduating college and going to South Africa right after college before law school to work on human rights issues and through the divestment movement. There initially became familiar with many of these concepts and goals of corporations. I was then in the administration at the National Security Council as director for multilateral and humanitarian affairs, so I looked at many of these issues from the governmental angle. And for the last 5 years, have been a partner in the practice of law studies law firm called Foley Coad in their DC office, where we have what we think is the only U.S. practice based exclusively in corporate social responsibility issues. It was founded by a guy named Pierre Smith, who was at the State Department, Boston Employment Administration, as the kind of number two for human rights issues. He then went to Levi Strauss, actually, in the late 90s, where he was VP of corporate social responsibility and then started this practice, and I came 5 years ago to assist him. We primarily advise multinational corporations on a whole range of international human rights, labor rights, indigenous rights, occasionally environmental issues. But we also do a lot of work with multilateral institutions. And on the issue of code of conduct, we have written three books over the course of the last 2 years with the World Bank and the IFC looking specifically at codes of conduct. We looked at them in five different fields. Apparel, footwear, manufacturing is one field, oil, gas, mining, agribusiness, and tourism, to see the kind of degree of convergence there was in those fields in terms of what's actually in the codes of conduct. This was done about 3 years ago, but then we did do a follow-up kind of looking at implementing mechanisms about 2 years ago and what needs to be the next steps in all this. So we work a lot with multilateral institutions. We also work quite a bit with NGOs. And frequently try to be bridge builders between the NGO community and the private sector. For instance, we do quite a bit of work for BP. We did all the advisory work on human rights and labor rights on the BTC pipeline through Azerbaijan, Georgia, and Turkey. And when Amnesty International launched a campaign against it for a number of reasons, served about 3 years, 3 months as the negotiators to help resolve that when Amnesty ultimately withdrew their campaign, but put in place a series of implementing mechanisms for the codes and for other issues down the line, which we've also helped to fulfill, such as monitoring and auditing for labor rights issues over the course of the last few years. So is CSR effective or codes of conduct effective? And I would say off the bat that my initial answer is absolutely yes, that they do help to promote higher qualities of life for employees, more engagement in local communities, more transparency, less corruption, better environmental standards, a whole host of things. But this has got to be seen against the backdrop of what's really pushing this. I'd say, first of all, globalization. Obviously, the world is increasingly globalized and interconnected, and so issues like transparency are much easier in many ways the more you have access to information by a range of stakeholders. Two, the sheer power and size of large multinational corporations. I think the latest statistic I saw was that of the 100 largest economies in the world, over half were multinational enterprises, and so they obviously have a very large stake in this worldwide economy. Three, the growth of different stakeholders creating many, many more demands on many of these companies. So now we include in stakeholders not only shareholders, employees, customers, consumers, suppliers and business partners, but also competitors, home and host governments, international and regional organizations, lenders, and international institutions, and then the whole range, the whole panoply of advocacy organizations, human rights groups, organized labor, consumer groups, environmental groups, religious groups, universities, and then media. So a range of drivers on the stakeholder side. And then lastly, the risks of not acting in a socially responsible manner are far more acute. And so we divide this up into kind of both negative business drivers and positive business drivers. And I hope I'm not repetitive of what's been said before, but on the negative business driver side, you certainly see legal risks. So under the Alien Tort Claims Act here in the U.S., lawsuits brought against many multinational corporations, particularly oil and gas companies. But also the concurrent legal development elsewhere, so what we call foreign direct liability, potential laws as liability and criminal liability for corporations in jurisdictions other than where those wrongs are occurring. But also the whole, and then you've got political risk, congressional investigations, which we've dealt with for some clients, sanctions laws, and then the whole range of reputational risks, which arguably in this day and age, the damage to a reputation, a corporate brand, can be far more damaging for the corporation than a legal risk. So shareholder divestment suits, boycotts, resolutions, attacks on corporate property, major media attention, NGO actions, a whole range of things. And then, of course, there's also positive drivers that many companies see this as a way to brand themselves. It's the right thing to do. It's brand protection. It's anticipating and managing business risks more effectively, increased customer and employee loyalty and retention. One thing we saw as we were doing the study for the World Bank was that it resulted frequently in increased employee morale, better relations with the host government, which was because frequently these companies were enforcing laws that the country itself was not able to, more transparency because they were doing better reporting. So positive drivers as well. On the issue of codes of conduct in particular, we divide up the kind of CSR world, and I just wrote an article on this for a New Journal that I sent along. I'm not sure if people can or not, but we basically divide up the CSR history over the last 10 or 15 years. And this is, at the end of the day, a fairly new emerging field. I mean, most people track, although it was around before the mid-90s, certainly it gained a lot of attention in the public eye in the mid-90s with this sweatshop labor issues, Kathleen Gifford, Nike, Reebok, President Clinton convened the White House Apparel Industry Partnership. At the same time, the oil and gas industry, Kenshiro Wiwa's death and the role of Shell in Nigeria and that, the idea of corporate publicity. And so over the last 10 or 15 years, it's really been driven forward. And we kind of divided it into CSR 1.0, which was kind of the initial realization of what companies have to do on the CSR front. And this was really the development of codes of conduct. And 10 years ago, when very few companies had codes, I think Levi's was the first that had a code in either 91 or 93. So we're talking still about a very recent phenomenon. Now, the vast majority of multinationals have codes. And so we actually look at it as, then how is the industry maturing? So what we call CSR 2.0 is actually the implementation of that. And what are the whole range of issues around the code? And then CSR 3.0, which we kind of say we're in right now, is the issues involved in implementing it, including things like supply chains and how far down your supply chain do you go, how else do you try to push the demands onto your suppliers, consumers, a whole range. So in terms of whether codes of conduct can work, I think yes, absolutely, but not in a vacuum. It's no longer good enough for a company just to have a code of conduct. And this is where we try to distinguish ourselves with lawyers from what CSR has developed elsewhere in the kind of communications field in terms of PR and loss and putting out good, nice, you know, brochures saying what you do. And we say, you know, CSR is not necessarily corporate, it's not just corporate philanthropy, it can be a small element of it, but that's not just it. It's not just being a good citizen, it's actually systemically changing the company and then putting in place mechanisms to ensure that those things are implemented. So on the implementation side, there's starting to be a whole group of industries catered towards implementing them, helping companies to take that code and then audit it, encouraging other stakeholders to get engaged, hold companies to those standards. You have internal auditing versus external auditing. There's whether you report and how transparent you are in those reportings or not. There's a whole range of voluntary stakeholder groups. For instance, in the oil and gas industry, there's something called the Voluntary Principles on Security and Human Rights. There's a real estate department in the UK jointly put together along with NGOs and corporate participation. And that the whole stumbling block right now has been ongoing for about 5 years. There are about 15 leading companies that are part of it, about 7 or 8 leading NGOs, 4 governments. It's been going along great until we start getting to the issue of, well, how do you actually implement this? What do companies actually have to do to report on this? And how can they show that this is not just PR gloss? So that, to me, is a really, really critical distinction in where the field is now. How do you take what's in a code and ensure that it's not just rhetoric? One way, and I'll stop here so we can get more to Q&A, is looking closely at some of these codes and what companies do to report on them. Talisman Energy is one of our clients. It's a second largest Canadian oil and gas company, which report from a year ago is, first of all, benchmarked against Global Reporting Initiative guidelines, which I think at this point only about 30 or 40 companies actually do. And then, in addition to being benchmarked against a true international best practices standard, is independently audited by PricewaterhouseCoopers as well to ensure that everything they say is in fact transparent. And so, due to the various drivers, whether negative or business, the positive that I mentioned, if you can get a company to take those next steps and to ensure that that it goes beyond the rhetoric and beyond the PR, then I think codes of conduct truly are successful with very potentially far-reaching repercussions for the whole range of the stakeholders involved in those companies.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. I really don't know what to say. I mean, this gentleman really said whatever was necessary to say in this topic.
Sorry.
I'll try to make up something. Well, I'm trying to, I was thinking of giving you a different perspective. As a little background, I'm a attorney in Bolivia. I work with power and energy. I am an in-house lawyer for a Canadian company. But at the same time, I love the academic work, so I'm working with some studies, especially related to corporate governance. I completely agree with Daniel when he says that, of course, code of conduct can promote responsible corporations. The question is how to do that, you know? And I have a little thesis, so to speak, in regard to countries as mine, which are ruled by the civil code system. How can we start thinking about corporate governance? I mean, as you all know, this topic became very famous, especially at the end of the 90s with the Asian crisis, and then the problems with American corporations. Ironically enough, at that moment, I was finishing my law school when Enron was crashed down. And this topic became very interesting in countries as mine, Bolivia, where we received international investors. As you may know, we privatized all state companies, the oil and gas industry, and so on. So this is a very important thing in Bolivia, and of course in most Latin American countries. If you think about corporate governance as a whole structure that provides companies the means to get their own objectives and to start controlling their own objectives, you will end up with a valuable instrument, tool to create. And those are the principles that were written down by many institutions, the OECD, the CAP, the World Bank, you know. And those are basically the same, you know, seeking for the protection of the stakeholders as a whole, protection of shareholders' interests, promote economic efficiency, promote sustainable growth, and attract investors. Because if you have a corporation with corporate governance principles and good practices, of course you're going to attract investment and the trust of investors in your country and abroad. So this will lead us to an improving relationships, not only between management and shareholders, management and board, but also the rest of the stakeholders, you know, like workers, society, NGOs, the state, etc. And the big question is just arrived at this moment: how to improve those relationships among all those stakeholders by making them more responsible? And then you have to use incentives. The carrot and the corporation is more profitable, the country and the globe and the whole thing will improve. After a little study we ran at the Catholic University in Bolivia, we ended up with a funny conclusion. We established that most Latin American countries had almost all corporate governance principles in their own commercial or civil codes. For instance, Bolivia enacted the last commercial code in 1976. And most principles of corporate governance are already there. I don't know, accountability, board accountability, management accountability, transparency in information, protection of shareholders, equalitarian treatment among all shareholders, etc., etc. All those principles you would find at the OECD and all the corporate governance models that we have now. The real problem is that there is a poor law enforcement and a poor communication of these principles. This is a statute of these provisions in many laws. We think that having codes of conduct will eventually help corporations, not only transnational corporations, but domestic corporations, to really enhance their responsibility. What are, in that regard, goals in Bolivian companies? And those are goals not only for corporations that were incorporated in Bolivia, but corporations as, Petrobras, British Petroleum, who are actually investing a lot of money in Bolivia. They want to improve the relationships, especially between boards and the shareholders. They want sound and accurate financial information. And those are the problems that we face in Bolivia at this moment. Why do I think that code of conducts are good in this regard? Because they are provisions, in a sense, tailor-made for each company. You have time to sit with the board members, the shareholders, and start writing down, according to those principles and other forms and models that are around the world, special provisions for the special necessities of this company. What else? It's important because you can admit those codes of conduct from time to time. And you can monitor, you can control the fulfillment of those provisions internally. I think that the poor law enforcement in Bolivia was the main problem regarding this corporate governance provisions and goals. But if you have a company that is able to get those principles written down in a code of conduct, and you, in a sense, spread the benefits to do that, corporations are gonna be better benefited with this system. This is basically it. I really don't want to repeat anything that was already said here, but I'll be very happy to participate in the Q&A.
Well, thank you all, and we have some time for questions. We'll ask you, we'll turn to the audience. Yes.
My name is Norita Katakezawa, and I'm from Japan. And it was great to hear the human rights and the corporate responsibilities from my neighbors, country's professors. And I'm studying human rights here, and sometimes I struggle about the concept of human rights because Japan and maybe Korea or Taiwan also imported the concept from the Western country. So my question is very biased, but I'm sorry about that. But what should Southeast Asian should think about human rights? And sometimes human rights become used politics in our region. So I want to give, I want to have some tips from professors.
Yeah, I understand your question as human rights can be different based on the specific situation of country, kind of situation, or any social situation. Well, basically, human rights is universal. Nobody denies that. But some specific, I think this is a general answer. But in specific cases, sometimes we need to address more specific standards. For example, nowadays the Burma official Burma is under sanction from not only the United States, but also from the European Union. Because of their level of public relations or level of human rights. But there might be some difference of their potential as a means of achieving human rights. Sometimes it can continue to express their local dogmas, building dogmas. But where I have not yet any the case of which kind of mechanism that succeed to open, make open society or against human rights. Some reports from the United Nations, the organization country deteriorate make worse the situation of the people of so but anyway, the notion of the human rights is very diverse and big, huge notion. Even if I include not only civilian political rights, but also nowadays, a lot of the issues can be discussed under the name of human rights. But basically, human rights is negotiable, cannot be discriminated based on the current or social situation. But specifically, it can be built with.
Can I just address one point of this issue? I think after human rights concerns was very diverse in East Asia countries, and it's also I agree with my colleagues' point that it's very universal concerns. But my suggestion for the East Asian countries to cooperate together, we can do for the starting point at labor standards. Because right now Japan, Korea, or China, or here Taiwan and ASEAN countries, we a lot of us make an effort to have the free trade negotiation and want to cooperate the free trade agreements together and go at the whole free trade area in Asia. So we cannot cooperate with the labor standards.
more we can do to bring China and other countries into the tent and to help raise the standards altogether, the better we all be for it.
Other questions?
Very quickly, that's quite a difficult question, but I can give you a bit of information about the financial regulatory system in this country and how human rights and other activists have made use of it. First, you have the decision to create a system of transparency in the interest of shareholders who may not be so concerned about human rights and the environment and so on and so forth. Then, though, you have civil society, non-governmental organizations, who use the transparent information because it's freely available over the internet, publicly available information. They also often become shareholders, and they make use of your shareholder proposals and various other devices, and they also may even sue to force more disclosure, but they have their own agenda, their own objective. So sometimes as nations' economic systems move along and include things like more transparency, even though the transparency is dedicated toward economic profit-making goals, it might still be more available to civil society so that they can take advantage of it and use their own leverage and pressure to make it through. So I don't have a perfect answer, but that's just the thought.
Well, I was going to say, obviously, in addition to whatever regimes you have, the national laws and regulations, which are still the focus, I think, of implementing most of these mechanisms. CSR, by and large, I alluded to this point, but has developed industry sector by industry sector because the sectors are so individualized in terms of what drives them, what they have to do to respond. And so I think most people would agree that the sector that's most mature is probably at this point apparel, footwear manufacturing, light manufacturing, because that was the first industry really targeted in the mid-90s, and as a result, far more companies have responded. I'd say soon after that would be extractive sector, which again, because of all the issues it had in Nigeria and Colombia elsewhere, has developed these voluntary multi-stakeholder codes. One that's up there for being relatively mature is the financial sector, and it's because of the leadership primarily of the IFC and the World Bank and putting together the Equator Principles at this point. So over the last two or three years, the Equator Principles have really filled a much needed void and have been taken quite seriously. And the IFC just rolled out the kind of 2.0 version of that last year. Now, it's still voluntary and there is no monitoring of it. But I think that will be the next thing that the industry really grapples with. And I know that they're talking about it right now. It's pretty significant that over the last 4 or 5 years, you've gotten an initiative like that I think something like 87, 80% of loans over, whatever implement that across industry sectors. No industry sector has really figured out how to implement all that well. Again, because it was first, the manufacturing, light manufacturing and apparel, has probably gone the furthest. And so you've seen at first, like where financial sector is now, it was just incumbent on each company to report what they were doing. Then it became, you know, their own independent audits, internal audits. Then they went to external auditing. So they had a variety of auditing companies around the world that would go and do the reporting, but make it public only to the company. And the company could choose to do with it what they would. And very few have made those public. I think Nike last year released, they didn't release the company names of the facilities, but they made everything else transparent about what the auditing showcased. But then the furthest step that I've seen in auditing is then within the manufacturing sector, this group called the Fair Labor Association, and actually was the successor to the White House Apparel Industry Partnership that Clinton put together. And it now has a number of leading companies, 20 or so, plus NGOs, plus educational institutions, about 60 or 70 educational institutions, which use branded sweatshirts and all the range of the rest of those things that deal with manufacturing issues quite a bit. And they all the companies put money into a central pool, which the FLA then decides which companies audit it. So the companies themselves have no say, as they did in the past, over which external monitor does the auditing. And then those external monitors, without the company's knowledge, come and do the auditing and make their results known to the FLA as opposed to the individual company. So that is very recent in the last year or so. And it remains to be seen how well received it is and how many companies actually will do something like that. And these are real leadership companies that are part of it. But it at least provides a model going forward for what can be done in the auditing and implementation realm.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I think we're about at the end of our session. Please give our excellent